This information is subject to a disclaimer at the end of this podcast. Please ensure that you listen to the disclaimer and go to www.ubs.com for further information about UBS.
Hi, everyone, and thanks for tuning into UBS Global Research Pod Hub, a channel that shares insights from economists, strategists, and equity analysts on the pivotal questions and events shaping today's markets. My name is Sambuddha Ray, Head of Product Management for Global Macro Research, and I'm joined today with Jonathan Pingle, our Chief U.S. Economist. Today, we are going to discuss Jonathan's thoughts on the current shape of the U.S. economy, outlook for the rest of the year, Fed, and much more. It's going to be an insightful podcast, so stay tuned. Jonathan, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Great. Let's go straight at it. So 2021 and 2022 saw a sharp rise in prices around the world, and central banks had to hike rates at a rapid pace. And as a result, most market forecasters had anticipated that as inflation starts receding, due to the speed and the quantum of the rate hikes, economies will materially slow down. That was the common narrative. But the US economy has shown remarkable strength all this while. Although growth in other advanced economies like Germany or UK have been quite lackluster. So I guess the question for you, Jonathan, is why do you think America has pulled out ahead of other developed economies? And what, in your view, has been the biggest surprise or learning for all of us?
So when we look across the advanced economies, and also even if we just look specifically at the US and the composition of growth, you know, two things at the moment really stand out. One in particular, which really is the fiscal stimulus. I mean, the magnitude and scale of what the U.S. federal government unleashed was really extraordinary. I mean, you're talking, you know, 20% of nominal GDP, a fiscal expansion of a magnitude not seen since the Second World War in the U.S. And the nature of the fiscal expansion, also with direct transfers to households, as well as subsidies to businesses to retain employees. And on top of that, it was also followed by very pro-business fiscal policies passed by the Biden administration, including the CHIPS Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, and the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. And these fiscal programs, you know, significantly bolstered household balance sheets, allowed households to delever during the pandemic, and the incentive for private industry to invest domestically, reshore, onshore, has helped sustain a certain amount of that fiscal stimulus. And this really has been, I think, a distinguishing feature of the U.S.'s expansion relative to a lot of the other developed markets, but it was something that also helped really propel and fuel the rebound out of the pandemic. And, you know, we estimate that in 2023, a year where real GDP growth was over 3%, that over one percentage point of that growth was due to fiscal contributions to growth. We've also benefited a lot from net international migration. Now, at first, this seemed to be an inflationary labor market tightening shock when the borders were closed. Mm-hmm. U.S. population growth is heavily reliant on net international migration. But in the years since the borders reopened, you know, we've seen a relative surge, and this does seem to have cooled some of the tightest and hottest parts of the labor market. And those two things together have helped sustain growth, give the economy a little more room to run, and also help moderate inflationary pressures. So it has certainly been a good thing for the Federal Reserve to see. Now, in terms of the biggest surprise and learnings net of those positive contributions, I have to say consumer spending strength has been a particular surprise. Consumers have proved somewhat resilient to the rapid tightening cycle. Mm-hmm. And we've seen also certain signs of stress that we thought would play into a slower pace of consumer spending. But we've seen very much a sort of tale of two households, where the upper 20% of households, the upper 20% of the income distribution, I should say, seems very, very flush with cash and high levels of wealth. And many of the indicators of more hardship, whether it's rising delinquency rates or low saving rates, that has started to weigh, it looks like, on the bottom 80% of the income distribution. But on net, that has really, the stronger than expected consumer spending strength has really helped power the expansion, and along with fiscal stimulus, really been what drove the outperformance in 2023. The second surprise and learning, I think, has really been the speed of the private sector reaction to the Biden administration fiscal programs. Now, when you look at the history of programs, even like the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, the spend out of these programs is often relatively slow, and private sector reactions can vary quite a bit, but they usually tend to lag somewhat. That really was not the case with the response to what we've seen in some of the investment in the private sector reacting to these incentives created in the Biden administration programs. The speed with which we began manufacturing, plant construction, and other types of investments due to the CHIPS Act and the IRA was really, really quite extraordinary. It was almost like a level shift up, and that structure's investment contributed roughly half a percentage point on its own to Q4 GDP growth in 2023. So something that we thought would be spread over a period of years really showed up almost all at once and helped drive the 2023, not just outperformance, but better than expected economic outcomes overall. So looking back at really what's driven the U.S. growth, certainly consumer spending has been one, but fiscal policy has played a substantial role as well.
That's actually super clear. So looking forward now, remind us, what is our growth forecast for this and next year?
So we expect to see slower growth in the coming quarters. We have growth slowing to roughly 1.5%, a hair lower Q4 over Q4 in 2024, before reaccelerating to something a little over 1.5% in 2025. And a lot of that slowdown is our expectation that this fiscal thrust slows. The level of this activity that's been pushed up has been, it's been pushed up so rapidly, and the level's been pushed up so high, it's just going to be difficult to build the same amount of ongoing growth on top of it. And at the same time, we are seeing a certain amount of budget tightening amongst federal and state governments. So the federal government is putting spending caps in place. There have been some pieces of legislation that we actually expected to pass that would have added to federal spending this year, but Congress has actually been relatively slow to move on some of these measures. So we are watching restraint being put in place at the federal level, and state budgets are also starting to come under increasing pressure. State government revenue was down in 2023. Some of the largest states, such as California, are trimming their budgets and spending. And the pace of public sector infrastructure investment, when we look at the construction data, has slowed quite sharply. It's basically been flat over the last 3 months after a very strong 2023. So putting all of that together, that sort of one percentage point plus thrust or addition to growth in 2023, we expect falls to roughly zero actually in 2024. There doesn't seem to be any particular acceleration going on in business investment, and we do expect the ongoing weight of higher interest rates to cool consumer spending at least a little bit at this point. So taking out the fiscal thrust, still some weight of higher interest rates constraining consumer spending suggests to us that we do have a slowdown ahead, taking out some of the very strong growth in 2023 for 2024 and 25.
Uh-huh. So as I understand, we expect a gradual slowdown of growth, but not a hard landing, right?
Well, I mean, it would be a relatively soft landing. It's no hard landing. We're not expecting, material disruption in the labor market, just a somewhat soggier patch of growth than I think we've seen, and probably a little bit softer than I think what the consensus forecasts are expecting.
Okay. Now that we understand the growth dynamics a bit, I'm going to shift focus to inflation. This has been one of the hottest topics, or a topic of debate, of intense debate, I would say, for more than 2 years now. At the end of last year, we did see inflation start declining a little bit. But again, in the last couple of months, the data shows some sort of a reacceleration. So, Jonathan, what is driving this research? And if I may extend that question a little bit further, when do you think we are going to see inflation going back to the Federal Reserve's target of 2%?
Well, yeah, so this is a great question. We've made a substantial amount of progress on inflation. In fact, those were Chair Powell's words last week in his comments at Stanford. But when we think about what's unfolding now, we are seeing some stalling out in that trend of improvement. And in the month-over-month changes, yes, there's been sort of a backing up that might look like reacceleration, but when I think about what we're getting in core PCE prices and sort of what's unfolding, I'd say it's more sort of bumps up and down. And there's just simply been more halting, or let's say only stubborn progress, compared to what I think we and the Federal Reserve had hoped for. But, we should see core PCE inflation in the March data, based on what we've seen in the CPI and PPI data this week, step down to, 2.7%. Now it's, better than 2.8. It certainly moved down below 3 last year, and it's better than the, 5% plus we were talking about in 2022. But it's still a ways from the Fed's 2% objective. And the question is, how much further progress are we going to make as we get there? Now, it does seem likely that inflation is going to continue to trend lower here, at least in our view. We have been a little bit disappointed waiting for, some of the rent data, which, if we look at what's being reported in other data sources, has slowed by more than what's in the official inflation data. We've also seen a certain amount of cooling in nominal wage growth. Average hourly earnings in the most recent employment report had slowed to 4.1% over the year. That's back actually into, sort of the pre-COVID range for nominal wage growth. So, there are reasons to think inflation is going to continue to slow here, but there are certainly risks as well. We're going to get to a patch this summer where last year there were, very low monthly changes. I mean, that had sort of helped the acceleration and improvement lower. If we don't replace those monthly gains with equally low monthly gains, the year-over-year changes could start to rise again. And I think that would be very disappointing for the FOMC. Now, in our projections, we see core inflation at the end of this year at around 2.3% and then slowing to 2.1% next year. That's a little bit lower than the Federal Reserve's own median projections. They're expecting 2.6% inflation for this year. So I think most of us are expecting a certain amount of ongoing improvement, but I think a big question for the central bank is, how far does it go? And if it only gets to 2.6% and stalls, that could be very worrying for the Fed.
Understood. Okay. So where does this leave us with the timing of rate cut? And to what extent do you think that the Fed can cut in this cycle?
Yeah, so at the moment, the FOMC seems to feel the winds of growth filling their sails, and that has certainly given them the luxury or emboldened them to wait before starting to dial back monetary policy restrictiveness in order to assess the progress on inflation and ensure that it's really headed towards 2%. So the extent to which growth continues at this sort of 3% pace, or is perceived that non-farm payroll employment is going to expand 250,000, 300,000 a month, You know, the FOMC could probably wait quite a long time before cutting rates. Now, in our forecast, not just inflation, but we also have slower growth, which I think is going to be important in their calculus. I mean, put it this way, you know, inflation falling to 2.3% at the end of this year, that should be enough given where real rates would be and typical reaction functions that the Federal Reserve would start to lower interest rates. So we're expecting a 25 basis point rate cut at the September FOMC meeting and another 25 basis point rate cut at the December meeting. One thing that slower growth would also tell the committee, it would be a sign that their policy really is restrictive. Right now, the data has been, you know, quite strong. And I think the committee's questioning how restrictive monetary policy looks. They raised rates quite rapidly. You know, many of us thought that this was going to be quite restrictive policy. And yet growth has proven very resilient. If that growth and resilience continues, you know, there will be ongoing questions about just how restrictive monetary policy really is. If growth slows, however, I think that would be a sign to the committee that their policy really is restrictive. And if inflation's coming down too, then in order to balance the risks between, you know, getting inflation down and sustaining the economic expansion, I think they might want to get out of restrictive policy a little bit more quickly in 2025 than their current projections suggest. So when we look at the Fed's reaction function and the extent of the cutting cycle, you know, our forecast for inflation to get down to 2.3% this year and then core inflation down to 2.1% next year, combined with the slower growth that tells them that, you know, we really are being restrictive and that we're at risk of being too restrictive, you know, our expectation is that in 2025, they're going to take the funds rate back down, not 2-3%, but close to 3% in order to better balance the risks, remain somewhat restrictive, but also underwrite the economic expansion that I think they would like to see going. And if inflation is getting down to the sort of 2.1% we expect, you know, they're still going to want to get, I think, to 2.0, but I think they're going to be a little less willing to risk, you know, really damaging the expansion in order to accomplish that last 0.1 percentage point, if you know what I mean. But it's certainly not a deep path if we don't get a recession. But getting back something still mildly restrictive, but closer to the Fed's assessment of longer run neutral rate.
Excellent. That's actually super clear. I think the calculus that you explained between growth and inflation to assess the Fed's reaction path will be extremely useful for the listeners. I will now change the direction of this conversation slightly towards the upcoming US presidential election this year. Obviously, it's an important event. So what are your latest thoughts on how it may have any implications for the Treasury and the ever-growing government debt?
Well, it has potential to be quite a consequential presidential election on a number of fronts. You know, we've written about the impact potentially on trade policy, but yeah, also on fiscal policy. You know, in 2025, there is going to be what we sort of called a forcing event. You know, much of the individual side of the 2017 tax cuts expire by law and would be automatic tax increases for quite a wide range of the income distribution at the end of 2025. So our expectation is that, you know, Congress would want to address that fiscal cliff. Now, who's in the White House and who controls Congress, obviously, would have a material impact on how that's addressed, we expect. In a Biden administration, a second Biden administration, say, it does look like the election map for the Senate is relatively favorable for Republicans, just weighing who's up for election and looking at the polls. In a case of divided government, we would expect probably only a partial extension of those tax cuts and an expiration of those tax cuts for the upper income households. So taxes would rise for higher income American households. And similarly to the compromise that was reached during the expiration of Bush tax cuts, there could also probably be some pay-fors and other adjustments to the tax code that mitigate the overall cost of extending the tax cuts for the lower and middle income households. Now, if former President Trump wins re-election, you know, many of the proposals we've seen out of the Republicans in Congress, as well as from the campaign, would indicate an intent to fully extend all of the 2017 tax cuts and potentially cut taxes further elsewhere. It's also difficult to assess quite where the any offsetting cuts to spending would come from. So, to give you a sense of the magnitude, a full extension of those tax cuts, we estimate, would be about a $2.8 trillion deficit widening through the end of the budget window in 2033. So it's quite a material increase in deficits for the U.S., and at a starting point where debt to GDP today is much higher than it was back, say, in 2016 or 2017, when those acts were being considered and addressed. So it would be a much different potential fiscal outcome whether or not we have a Biden administration or divided government, or the potential for, say, a sweep if, say, the Republicans took both houses of Congress as well as former President Trump wins the White House, and you see this really full extension of the tax cuts and potentially additional tax cuts for businesses and households as well. And it also comes with a much different starting point for the national debt, which, you know, could have implications for the Treasury and bond markets in how that information is seen and built into yields. But certainly a consequential election for both fiscal and trade policy, and the range of potential outcomes for fiscal policy is quite wide, and something that is likely to be confronted soon after the presidential election because of the way the law is written and those tax cuts automatically expire, and which would be an automatic tax increase on quite a wide range of households. So it does seem like something that Congress and the White House would want to address.
Jonathan, this has been an extremely useful podcast already. But before we close this episode, I do want to ask you one last question. There's a plethora of data that are being released on the macro front in the US. But what to you are the most important signposts or data points that you would recommend for our listeners to keep an eye on as we step into the remainder of this year?
The first set of data I think is most worth keeping an eye on is probably initial claims for unemployment and the change in continuing claims for unemployment. So the unemployment insurance data, it has its problems. Sometimes it suffers from, you know, seasonal adjustment difficulties or administrative errors in reporting, but it's released weekly, and week after week, it's not only timely, but one of the best assessments of whether the labor market is weakening or slowing. And then I think given what we're seeing in the inflation data and its importance to the Federal Reserve, interest rates, and in turn this, the economic outlook, I would definitely have to say that the regular inflation releases of the CPI data and the PCE prices data from the BEA, which is what gets greater weight in the Federal Reserve's decisions, I think if we're watching anything, I really do think it should be probably those indicators. The unemployment insurance data, because it gives you a timely read on the labor market, and then the CPI and PCE prices data, because it'll weigh so heavily in the Federal Reserve's rate decisions.
Wonderful, wonderful. That's amazingly helpful. Many thanks, Jonathan, for your time.
Thank you very much.
Let me try to summarize what we learned today. Number one, the U.S.'s growth outperformance was primarily driven by the surprising strength in consumer spending and also the speed at which corporates reacted to the fiscal incentives that were provided by the government. Secondly, looking ahead, we don't expect any hard landing at the moment, but more like a gradual slowdown in growth. We at UBS expect the US GDP to grow at 2.3% in 2024 and then 1.4% in 2025. The slowdown in growth and the gradual drop in inflation means that the Fed could be able to take the base rate closer to 3% by the end of 2025. We expect the cutting cycle to start this year with a quarter point cut in September and another one in December. And lastly, the US elections in November will not only have geopolitical implications, but is likely to play a major role in how the fiscal situation pans out in the US. So keep a close eye on this topic. Well, thank you again for listening to this podcast. For details on everything that we discussed today or more on the US economy, please feel free to reach out to Jonathan Pingle and team. And for more such insightful conversations, keep listening to the UBS Research Pod Hub. There are a lot of market-relevant, important, and interesting content on a diverse set of topics. Until next time, this is me, Sambodh Hare, signing off for now.
This content has been prepared by UBS AG, its subsidiaries, and/or affiliates, and is purely informational in nature. It is not investment research and does not contain an investment recommendation, nor investment or professional advice. It is not an offer or solicitation to engage in any investment activity, and you should seek your own financial, tax, and legal advice before engaging in any such activity. UBS has no responsibility to you in relation to this content. It has no regard to your personal circumstances or investment objectives, and receiving it does not imply any form of client relationship with UBS for any legal, regulatory, or tax purpose. This content is not intended for distribution into any jurisdiction where to do so would be contrary to law or regulation. UBS does not accept any liability over the content of such material or reliance upon any information contained herein. The views and opinions expressed by any guest speaker or third party are not those of UBS. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over such views and opinions expressed by such persons. This content is the valuable intellectual property of UBS, and UBS specifically prohibits the redistribution of it in whole or in part without its prior written permission. Copyright UBS 2024. The key symbol and UBS are among the registered and unregistered trademarks of UBS. All rights reserved.